Well, if you were here during our Advent series back in December, we had tried doing something a little different. Steve and I tried to preach the Christmas story by giving first-person narratives of various characters associated with the story. And we got a couple pieces of feedback from that. One of those pieces of feedback was that a lot of you enjoyed sort of the narrative storytelling approach and just a different way of doing the teaching. The other piece of feedback I got a bunch was that I said at the outset of that series that Steve would speak from the perspective of Mary, and he didn't, and many of you were disappointed in me about that. Now, to be fair, that was the original plan. It wasn't a bait-and-switch maneuver, but as we were going through the series, Steve just felt compelled to preach from a different perspective, so that's fair that these things happen. But as we begin our journey towards Easter, we're going to actually try and be sort of responsive to both those pieces of feedback that we got. And so we're going to walk through some of the gospel stories as we move towards Easter from a first-person perspective. And specifically, we want to view the events of the life of Jesus through the eyes of Mary, his mother, which means that by popular request, you will get Steve preaching from the perspective of Mary. It will happen. I almost promise it. I need to have a little bit of an out there. You know, as Steve and I were talking about this particular series a number of months back, you know, that picture of Mary standing at the foot of the cross, which Mike read for us just a few moments ago, was very much on our minds. Imagining those moments for her as she watched Jesus' life slowly ebb away. What was she thinking? What was running through her mind in those moments? How might she have reflected on Jesus' life standing there at the cross? In the book of Luke, there's this interesting little statement that pops up. It actually pops up twice in chapter 2, once as part of Jesus' birth story, and then again as part of a story of Jesus at age 12. The writer tells us that Mary treasured up all these things in her heart. It's a great little statement. There's this sense of Mary being a person who really, I think, took life in, pondering and considering and remembering, storing away memories as treasures in the depths of her soul. And so I wonder then, years later, being there at the cross where her son is dying, which of those treasured memories might she have sort of pulled out of the treasure box, so to speak? And how might she have considered Jesus' life from that perspective in those difficult moments? And so we want to try and think about that as part of this teaching series, putting ourselves in Mary's shoes. So today I want to reflect on a part of Mary's life that Mary will have remembered well, though Jesus wouldn't have because he was very young. It's an account found in Luke chapter 2, starting at verse 22. And so I'm going to read a portion of the text here for you from Luke 2, starting at verse 22. And once I'm done reading it, I'm going to move directly to offering a reflection of that story from the first-person perspective of Mary, imagining her thinking about that as she stands at the cross. Luke 2, starting at verse 22. When the time came for the purification rites required by the law of Moses, Joseph and Mary took him to Jerusalem to present him to the Lord. As is written in the law of the Lord, every firstborn male is to be consecrated to the Lord, and to offer a sacrifice in keeping with what is said in the law of the Lord, a pair of doves or two young pigeons. Now there was a man in Jerusalem called Simeon, who was righteous and devout. He was waiting for the consolation of Israel, and the Holy Spirit was on him. It had been revealed to him by the Holy Spirit that he would not die before he had seen the Lord's Messiah. Moved by the Spirit, he went into the temple courts. When the parents brought in the child Jesus to do for him what the custom of the law required, Simeon took him in his arms and praised God, saying, "Sovereign Lord, as you have promised, you may now dismiss your servant in peace. For my eyes have seen your salvation, which you have prepared in the sight of all nations, a light for revelation to the Gentiles, and the glory of your people Israel. The child's father and mother marveled at what he said about them. Then Simeon blessed them and said to Mary, his mother, "This child is destined to cause the falling and rising of many in Israel, and to be a sign that will be spoken against, so that the thoughts of many hearts will be revealed, and a sword will pierce your own soul too." It was a warm spring afternoon when Joseph and I made our way through the busy streets and up the stairs towards the temple. The temple building itself was located on a much larger platform, itself the size of some small villages we had visited before. Jerusalem, and the Temple Mount especially, was a popular place, a destination really. And every time I had visited, there was so much interesting activity going on. It was people watching heaven. I assume that on that particular day, there was the usual activity, people strolling by with friends, running into acquaintances, pausing to share the day's news, maybe share a joke or two. Soldiers from the occupying forces peering down onto the Temple Mount from their watchtower on the north side. Plenty of beggars parked here and there, hoping to cash in on the pilgrim's sense of God's mercy and their obligation to be generous too. Old people. There are always old people there, sitting in the various doorways or congregated on the shady side of a wall somewhere, enjoying the ambiance while staying comfortably cool. I assume it was like that on that day, because to be honest, I wasn't paying attention in the usual ways. For the first time ever, walking up the stairs and onto the Temple Mount, I carried in my arms the greatest gift I had known in my life. My first child, a baby boy. His name was Jesus. He was barely a month old on that day. And I couldn't stop gazing into his face as I followed Joseph on our way to the temple. I'm convinced everyone could have vanished in an instant, and I wouldn't have even noticed. Joseph also had his hands full that day. You see, this wasn't just any old pilgrimage to the temple. We were headed there to bring the burnt offering and the sin offering that the scroll of Leviticus required of us after the birth of our child. Now, technically speaking, the requirement in Leviticus was to bring a lamb in its first year as the burnt offering and a pigeon as the sin offering. But if you absolutely couldn't afford a lamb, there was a provision made to bring a second pigeon and offer it as the burnt offering instead of a lamb. That was the situation Joseph and I found ourselves in. We were two pigeon people. Now, don't be mistaken. Joseph was really good at his craft. Still, it was a tough economy, and business had been slow for Joseph back then, and a lamb was just out of the question for us. Thinking back to that moment, I wonder if that was a difficult walk for Joseph. Might it even have been embarrassing? Didn't really cross my mind at the time. I was just thinking of the bundle of joy I was carrying in my arms. But what Joseph had in his hands, those two pigeons, was a not-so-subtle declaration to all who saw us that we were low on the socioeconomic pole. And then it happened. I didn't see the man until he was almost in front of my face, though Joseph said later that from the moment we walked onto the Temple Mount, this man had taken a keen interest in us. I found out later that his name was Simeon. By the wrinkles on his face, I could tell he had already seen much of life, and yet in his eyes there was a gentleness, a softness, a kindness. Of all the people I had ever met in life, he seemed unusually disarming. So disarming, in fact, that when he asked if he could hold my son, there wasn't even a twinge of concern or hesitation in my body. In fact, it was as though something inside of me was screaming that he must hold Jesus. I held my son out to him, still surprised how quickly I had done so. If I was a betting woman, I would say that Simeon must have had grandchildren of his own, maybe even great-grandchildren, by the way he so gently slipped his arms under Jesus and supported his head and nestled him into his chest. For the first time, I finally took a moment to look up and glance around, noticed a bit of a crowd had formed around us. Certainly, the vast majority of people were just carrying on their business, unaware of our little exchange, but a few seemed drawn to the sight of this kindly old man cradling my son. And oh, did he smile as he stared into Jesus' face. I mean, I'm not going to lie. He was pretty cute. Jesus, that is. What seemed like a random encounter took on a new tone when Simeon started to speak. Barely had he started to talk, I knew his words were more than just his words. Sovereign Lord, as you have promised, you may now dismiss your servant in peace. For my eyes have seen your salvation, which you have prepared in the sight of all nations, a light for revelation to the Gentiles and the glory of your people Israel. A strange feeling washed over me, something I hadn't felt for months, not since my encounter with the angel who had told me about my soon-to-be miraculous pregnancy. Not that I had ever forgotten about that moment or that message from the angel, but it all came flooding back to me in a new way as this old man spoke these prophetic words over Jesus, reminding me this was no ordinary child. The angel had said that my son would be our people's new king. Holding Jesus, Simeon declared that he was looking into the face of salvation himself. My son, the king, who would save our people. And maybe even more than that, because Simeon also said he would be a light for the Gentiles. It dawned on me that maybe God's plan was even bigger than I anticipated. Joseph and I were marveling at these words, so much so that I barely heard the blessing Simeon spoke over us as he put Jesus back into my arms. The small crowd that had gathered started to disperse. Joseph turned to talk to a man that he recognized in the crowd. I think I was the only one who really noticed that Simeon hadn't moved an inch. He just kept standing there in front of me. And his eyes now not staring at Jesus, but staring directly at me. And then, just loud enough so I could hear him, he said, "This child is destined to cause the falling and rising of many in Israel, and to be a sign that will be spoken against, so that the thoughts of many hearts will be revealed, and a sword will pierce your own soul too." As I heard the words, it was like dark threads being woven into what had been, up to this moment, a bright tapestry of hope and angelic words and beautiful prophecy. For the first time, it crossed my mind that there might be a shadow side to what would be part of Jesus' story, maybe my story too. Now, at the time, it was all about the future of something that would be, of something down the road. As a mom with a new baby, it didn't take me long to find myself back in the moment and relishing this exciting season of life that God had brought. Of course, time has a way of giving new perspective, doesn't it? And now, 3 decades later, those words come flooding back to me. No longer a glimpse of some unknown future, but now as a present reality that seems to be the only thing I can think about. For whatever Simeon meant by his words, certainly in these last few years of his life, I've watched Jesus become one of the most divisive individuals of our time. Not that he was trying to be, but just by virtue of what he said and what he did and what he claimed, well, people took sides when it came to Jesus. There were those who loved him more deeply than I thought anyone could love him but me. And there were those who, well, here he hangs on a criminal's cross, dying. That's about all you need to know about how viscerally others rejected him. How can people hate so deeply? "A sword will pierce your own soul too," he said. Seemed like hyperbole at the time, a little bit over the top. But now, it's a line I can't stop thinking about. because there's no other way to describe how wounded and broken I feel standing at my son's cross. I admit that being here these last hours and seeing Jesus suffer, I have had to wrestle with some dark thoughts. Maybe God has forgotten us. Maybe God has forgotten me. A week ago, it looked like maybe the moment for Jesus to become king and to save us, which is what the angel said would happen and what Simeon said would happen. It looked like it was happening. And now, not only has it not happened, our king, my son, is dying. A week ago, I thought, any day now, I'm going to see him sitting on a throne. Instead, he's on a cross. Has God forgotten? Has my longing been in vain? Has my waiting been for nothing? Sovereign Lord, as you have promised, you may now dismiss your servant in peace. That was Simeon's opening line to me that day. Like all God's most devout followers, he had been waiting, longing for the day God would send the one who would save us. He even claimed that God told him that he would lay his eyes on that Savior before his life came to an end. Once I found that out, you know, the gentleness with which he had held Jesus and the long gaze of his eyes on Jesus' face made all the more sense, as did his seemingly strange words. Sovereign Lord, as you have promised, you may now dismiss your servant in peace. His eyes had finally looked upon that gift he had been waiting for, longing for, and now he could meet his end in peace. I wonder how long he waited. How much time passed between getting the word from God and then seeing it fulfilled? Was it days, months, years? Was it decades? I mean, how long did he have to wait? I didn't even wait a full year between the angel's message to me and the day I finally held Jesus in my hands, and still all my friends kept telling me how impatient I was waiting. What if it had been decades from when the angel gave me the message until it was fulfilled? Would I have persevered in waiting? And did Simeon ever feel like giving up? Did he ever second guess if he had heard God right or not? I mean, for me, most of my waiting time came with pretty solid evidence that what I longed for was indeed on the way. It was a promise literally growing inside of me. What did Simeon have to hold on to, other than his conviction about God's character and work? And a solitary word he believed he had been given who knows how long ago. And yet in the end, Simeon was vindicated in his waiting. For however long his waiting was, however agonizing it may have been to know what he longed for, and yet see no evidence around him that would happen anytime soon, in the end, he was not disappointed. You know, on that day over 30 years ago, my heart was warmed and the world was full of hope and possibility. I was expectantly waiting for the day Jesus would save us. Now, standing at the foot of the cross, I wonder, am I crazy to still wait? Is it silly for me to even dare hope? And yet, Simeon, I can't get that moment out of my head. He was so certain. Jesus was the hope he had been waiting for. And I find that even now in my own brokenness, something deep inside still dares to hope. How could I not? Would not giving up on waiting, would not giving up on hoping and longing, would that not be a sign that I was resigning myself to believe that God no longer had something better in store for this world than this? Or maybe serve as proof that I thought there were still some things God was powerless to do anything about. But I don't believe those things. You can't tell me that God is finished yet. My faith in God's work and unlimited power compels me to keep waiting and hoping and longing. Who knows? Maybe even this suffering becomes part of a path to a greater healing. For the life of me, I can't imagine any way in which this works out for good. I can't see it. But my not knowing God's plan doesn't mean there isn't one. Over and over again, our people have told stories of God working powerfully in impossible circumstances, and I believe he's still the same God. As I look at Jesus hanging on the cross, who knows? Maybe even this moment could somehow turn into another one of those stories. I can't give up waiting now. And you? What about you? What good thing, what God thing do you long for? What is that aching in your heart that is there because the world is not as God made it to be? And you're desperate for his redemptive power to touch your circumstances. What are you waiting for that you know aligns with the heart of our good and gracious God? What is it? How long have you been waiting? Are you tempted to give up waiting today? I know. Some of you wanted to get up and just shout back at me, but Mary, you don't get it. You don't know what I'm waiting for. You don't know what I'm longing for. If you did, and if you knew the circumstances of my life, you'd know how impossible it is to wait and trust and still believe God might do something. Friend, I don't want to minimize your pain, but that young man up there dying on the cross, that's my son. And God said he'd be a king. I'm with you. I know what it's like for faith and trust to be pushed to the absolute brink. I know the feeling of hope slipping away. I know the feeling like any more moment of waiting would be futile. I know what it's like to need a miracle. And yet, if I believe God is who he says he is, if the stories about him are true, then how can we call anything beyond hope? How can waiting for good not be part of our divine calling? Maybe in your waiting, you're beginning to wonder if God is simply forgotten. That your longing doesn't reach him, or it's just slipped his mind. You know, if Simeon was here today as one who endured in waiting, I think his words to us would be this: don't give up. God has not forgotten. He has not forgotten your sadness. He has not forgotten that you still want a baby in your arms. He has not forgotten your cry for healing. He has not forgotten that you need a job. He has not forgotten that you have bills to pay. He has not forgotten that you long for a companion. He has not forgotten what you've lost. He has not forgotten our nation. He has not forgotten that you've been betrayed. He did not forget about you. You do not wait alone, and you do not wait for nothing. Whether it's been 5 days or 5 decades, God has not forgotten you. Your longing isn't lost on him. Truth is, sometimes much is required in order for our patience to keep up with God's patient but good work. You can't outpatient God. So what are you going to choose to do? What are you going to choose to do? What will you do with that good thing that you are longing for today? waiting for. That thing that, as elusive as it feels in this moment, seems to carry all the marks of the good, reconciling, redeeming, saving, healing work that God promised he'd be up to in our world. How will you respond today? Maybe today Simeon's example challenges you to reflect again on what you should be persistently praying for in your lifetime, on the things you long to see happen in God's world or in your own family. Things that you will go on waiting and hoping for and trusting that God will one day let you see with your own eyes. Is this the moment that you give up? Or will you keep waiting? Will you believe that God can do more in your waiting than you can do in your doing? Will you let faith rise up in you again today to boldly approach God's throne of grace and say, God, you know my waiting. You know my longing. In my life, let my own eyes see your saving, redeeming, reconciling, healing work. God, let it be so. I want to invite you into a moment of reflection. And if you would, maybe just close your eyes, bow your head, just get into a posture in which to be silent before God. And very simply today, I want to invite you. If you are here with a longing, if you are here with something you're waiting for, waiting on God for, I want to invite you to take this opportunity again to bring it to him. I think the first thing we have to do is just be honest about what our longing is. Does it line up with what God is doing in our world, in your life? Is it the kind of thing that matches the heart of God? If you're here today and if your longing is for someone you don't like to come to ruin when Jesus calls us to love our enemies, then probably don't spend a whole lot of energy waiting for that. But if your longing reflects something of God's good character, if it reflects his mercy and grace and compassion, if it reflects something of his work to set the world right again, maybe there's someone your longing would come to surrender to Jesus. Maybe you're seeing someone suffering and you wish their suffering would be alleviated. Maybe it's a relationship you long to see restored or made new. These are the kind of things that are on God's heart too. They are a part of the work he is doing, and they are worth longing for, waiting for, hoping for, even when the circumstances seem impossible. And so if you have something like that on your heart today, then in a moment of silence, I'm going to just invite you to boldly come before God again and express that longing to him. Maybe you've already come to him with that earlier today in your own quiet time. That's fine. Do it again. Do it again. Maybe it's something you actually gave up waiting for a long time ago. And today would be the moment that you hear God say again, no, don't give up. Don't give up. Keep waiting. And maybe you would express that to him today. So just take a moment in God's presence. What are you longing and waiting for? Tell him. Tell him. If you've expressed something of your longing to God this morning, I want to give to you Psalm 27, 13, and 14 for your encouragement. I remain confident of this. I will see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. Wait for the Lord. Be strong and take heart and wait for the Lord. God, give strength and courage to my friends today in the waiting. And receive today our waiting as a sign of our faith that we believe you are a God still working for good and a God who can still do the impossible.